Welcome to Under the Fig Tree podcast with hosts Reverend Dr. Ben Haupt and Reverend Micah Glenn. In today's episode, Ben and Micah sit down with a special guest as they meditate under the fig tree.
What's up? Welcome back once again to another episode of Under the Fig Tree. I am your host, Reverend Micah Glenn, the Director of Recruitment here at Concordian Seminary in St. Louis. And of course, as always, joined by my highly esteemed guest, Ben Haupt. I know you're waiting for which Ben word I was going to choose.
That's it. We have this ongoing joke about Ben or Benjamin. So it's good to be together for another episode of the podcast. Hey, I've been getting to know some of our listeners lately, which is really cool.
Yeah.
We've had some visit campus. We've had some just send us an email out of the blue.
Right.
We don't have lots of social media channels to interact with listeners, but it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and we do, just so you know, when you send those emails, we do read them, even if we don't respond to them quickly. We try to take things into consideration when it comes to God and His church. There's a number of topics that we could undertake, but certainly when it comes to different routes to ordination or other church work vocations, we try to take those ones into consideration. Just know we're hearing, at least via email and rumor, and if opportunity comes, we'll try to respond to those.
Yeah, and so if listeners are interested in corresponding with us, go to csl.edu, and if you find the admissions page, which is just csl.edu/admissions, you'll find a page that has our contact information, and feel free to reach out to Micah and me. It'd be fun to correspond and interact with more of our listeners.
Absolutely.
So we have a special guest with us today.
We do.
And I am excited to get to introduce him a little bit. So let me do that. So Dr. David R. Schmidt is the Greg H. Bennett Memorial Professor of Homiletics and Literature. Homiletics is just a fancy word for preaching. Maybe he'll give us a more refined definition than I just gave, but Professor of Homiletics and Literature here at the seminary, started in 1995 and is now the chairman of the practical department and the chair of the homiletics instructors group, of which I am a part. He has his PhD from Washington University in English. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. I don't know. All kinds of topics come up, but 17th century literature. Maybe we'll chat a little bit about that. He was a pastor at St. John the Divine Lutheran Church in Chicago, Illinois, from 1990 to 1995, prior to coming to the seminary. He's written all kinds of articles on ConcordiaTheology.org about preaching. At one point, I even had... I'll admit this, I don't know if Dr. Schmidt even knows this, but at one point as a pastor, I wrote on my reading list, read everything that David Schmidt has written on preaching.
That's not bad self-coaching.
Because I didn't have you for any preaching classes. Oh. And when I read The Tapestry of Preaching for the first time, it was like all of a sudden the scales had fallen off my eyes and I had a vision for what in the world I was actually doing. I won't say how many years I was already preaching before I read that article, but it was tremendously helpful. So, listeners should know about ConcordiaTheology.org. I think we've spoken about it a time or two, but so Dr. Schmidt or Dave, great to be with you, and thanks for being on.
Yeah. When were you a student here? I don't even remember.
I was here from 2000 to 2005.
Okay.
And somewhere in there, you were on sabbatical.
I had a study leave, right, for the dissertation. Yeah.
And so I think that was maybe my second year when I probably would have taken you.
Right.
And then, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's great to be able to teach with you.
Yeah.
And work alongside of you. So we're interested. How did you become a pastor?
Wow. Yeah, that's a long story, actually. I went to a Lutheran grade school in Pagedale, and
Pagedale,
Missouri.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, here, just okay.
Right, yeah. I was gonna ask too.
Yeah, it's closed now.
Yeah, but that's it's the north side exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I lived on the north side. I was a boy, grew up in Normandy,
okay, here
in St. Louis, right, and went to a Lutheran school. And you know, that's kind of during the whole split in the Missouri Synod. So the church we were going to, we left that church and we moved. And I had so it was like in junior high, I was going to a new school. All of the students had been from feeder schools to this new public school, so I wasn't going to the Lutheran high school. I was going to a public high school, and I was a new kid. I didn't know anybody, and I was in a new church because of the split and the family had moved. And that's when confirmation happened. And I think all that isolation and change made confirmation something that I just kind of focused on, right? And so I just really enjoyed confirmation, unlike a lot of people's experiences of it. But I tended to enjoy it. And it was in that class that the pastor, who had known me, you know, not even a year, you know, just planted a seed and said, you know, you should think about becoming a pastor. Wow. And, you know, my mom was so pissed off. She was so angry. She just did not think that was right, that, you know, a pastor puts ideas like that into a young boy's brain. And, you know, so it was, I think my mom's being upset made it even better. You know, it's kind of like, oh, this might be good, you know. Right. So it was just a seed, you know, and I didn't run out and suddenly buy a cross and start walking around high school carrying my Bible or anything. It just was a normal high school experience. But there were, you know, there would be moments when I would filter things through the lens of that. It was kind of like you're just going out into the backyard and checking and seeing if it's still there, you know. So I'd be in a speech class, and I was in a speech and debate thing, and you know, it went really well, and that just, you know, the instructor there was saying, you know, you really should, you know, you got a gift for public speaking. And then that kind of made me think about, well, you know, there's a lot of public speaking and being a pastor, you know. And then there was you know, I was in played water polo, and the team, you know, there were some bad incidents that happened on the team, and you just needed to have somebody who was able to care for other people. And in doing that, the you know, I remember the coach just telling me, you know, you should think about counseling or something like that, because you know you have a heart for people. And then in my mind I'm thinking, oh well, being a pastor, heart for people. So it was a long process.
Yeah.
And I just kind of stumbled along, really. When I went to college, I had a double major in English and biblical languages, because, you know, maybe being a pastor, maybe teaching, maybe doing something else. And so it, there was no big conversion experience. A lot of people, you know, they have this moment in their life when they're brought to a crisis, and, you know, and they see things differently. And that's beautiful. You know, you have a certain, a sense of certainty and power that comes from events like that. I never had that.
Well, and I think that's a lot of, I would guess that's a lot of our student or our listeners' experience, is that, they're you know, not having those experiences all the time.
Right, yeah. So I remember one time I was talking with an evangelical friend of mine who had had one of these Damascus Road experiences. And, you know, he kept waiting. He asked me how I became a pastor, and I kind of was telling him, and he kept waiting for me to have that powerful experience. And then, you know, and I'm just kind of saying, well, and then I went to seminary, and then I graduated and, you know, became a pastor. And he just was so keenly disappointed. And he looked at me and he said, so you're a pastor because nobody ever said no? And I'm like, yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, people affirm you, right? They see something in you and they affirm it, and you, the plant keeps growing. And then it finally is strong enough and stands on its own.
Well, I think if you took a poll of people on our campus and asked if it was a good idea for you to become a pastor and a preacher, I think it would speak probably pretty definitively to that friend's question, because I've heard many people describe you as the best preacher on campus. And I've even heard people describe you as one of the best preachers in Christendom. So I don't say that to puff you up, but just to say, you know, there is something about not having some big grand story, and yet you're a proclaimer of the gospel,
right?
And God has used you in enormous ways. Without having that big conversion experience.
So. Right, yeah. And it's something you live with for a long time, and you become accustomed to it, right? I do know that, you know, once I was a pastor in a parish, it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. The intimacy, the way you're involved in people's lives and doing the work of God, you draw closer to God, you draw closer to His people.
Yeah.
It is such a beautiful vocation. And
Yeah, and so that's fantastic. We always like to hear our guests and kind of how they became pastors, because And I think even our students, these are not stories that we often tell as professors in the classroom, but every pastor has an origin story, to use the comic book series. I just read a great book that will be coming out.
I'm glad it's not Origin.
Right,
Church Father.
Yeah, that's a whole different thing. We had Joel Olowski on earlier. Well, and Jeff Oswald, and they both talked about Origin. So, no, I'm a big comic book fan, so I'm always thinking about origin stories, and my boys are always asking me about those. So, how did you become a pastor is kind of the origin story for a pastor. Well, we want to transition a little bit. We've been talking about parables, and our listeners have been kind of going through this series with us, in which we have explored a whole bunch of different parables, and it's been really into the nitty-gritty details of the text, and what does this parable mean, and different exegetical theories, and it's been great, but we're bringing this series to a close, and we're wanting to hear a little bit about what is it like to preach a parable.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, like, you know, you approach a text and you're looking at it and you're, I mean, everybody has a different way of probably preparing a sermon. I typically look at the original text, then I read it a bunch of times. And then one of the things I do is I like to sit in like a coffee shop and look at strangers and think to myself, how would it apply to this random person that I don't quite know? Mm-hmm. And that way, I'm at least as little as possible trying to implant myself into the text.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then you come up with illustrations. I typically use personal stories because it brings me into the sermon, and I feel less dry and stale if I kind of begin with something at least connected to me in some way. But parables kind of offer their own illustration. in mm-hmm. just the design of what they are. And I not that I find trouble preaching parables, but I typically do a little bit less of what I was saying before and a little more of the text. That we can go into different styles of preaching, which is actually probably a good thing, because you're the professor of homiletics. You're not the sole professor of homiletics at this institution. But again, like Ben was saying, I had you for Hom 1. Everybody's back in the day of the old registration. Everybody's rushing to get into Dr. Schmidt's courses if they're open. So we keep saying homiletics. It's preaching, but
yeah.
can you like give a definition to homiletics? Because it's a little more than just preaching, because you can be preachy without being a homiletician, in my opinion.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, that the word preaching can have negative connotations today, right?
Right.
You know, you're real preachy. And the word homiletics has no connotations because nobody knows what it means, right? So it's kind of arising out of mutual conversation. Mm. Among the brethren, and you know, the to gather and speak together, homileo, this speaking together, the idea, it's interesting, in one of our old preaching textbooks with Richard Kemmerer, and then even before him, John Michael Roy, they like to think of the sermon as, I think it's Roy who calls it, a one-man homily, meaning it's a one-man conversation, that the preacher has been talking with the people and hearing what's going on in their lives, hearing how they're relating to the text, and he gathers all of those things together, and he creates this one-man conversation, which is reflective of how the people are experiencing this text. I mean, there's a biblical tradition of preaching where you're speaking in place of Christ and you're proclaiming his grace and forgiveness. And there's also a biblical tradition of preaching where the people are gathered together and speaking among one another. And the word homily is coming from that particular tradition. Heralding would be coming from the other tradition, and so it's but I think it's much better to just talk about preaching, as you know, there's a little bit of authority here. There's a, you know, it's a public proclamation. You're standing up in front of everybody else. I mean, you know, just, it's kind of odd today. Where do we have one person just stand up and speak for, in, you know, for a long period of time, every week,
right?
Yeah. So you've got one person standing up there, and he really is trying to do four things. He's trying to talk about this sacred writing that we've received from God. He's trying to teach a little bit of theology so that you have the capacity to understand these words when you study them on your own. He's centering everything he says in the life, death, and resurrection and return of Jesus Christ for our salvation. And he's trying to reach into your lives and help you grow in discipleship. And so preachers are trying to do those four things at once, and they will lean into certain aspects rather than others. So like you talking about how when you're working with a parable, you find yourself leaning more into the text and not doing the things you normally do in terms of addressing the lives of the hearers as much. That's a really good example, that different texts, different preaching occasions cause us to lean in different directions as we try to cover all four of those things in a sermon.
And that, for our listeners, what Dr. Schmidt just laid out is these four things that the preacher is doing is really kind of the fundamental idea of this tapestry of preaching and our entire curriculum for preaching here at the seminary. So that those four things as kind of an orientation and a guide in this activity of preaching, which is so complex and complicated and so many different, it has so many different manifestations, and yet those four things kind of really simplified everything for me and helped me to see that it's, yeah, it really is just those four things that I'm trying to do every Sunday, week in and week out, as I'm writing a sermon and delivering it and pouring myself into this message.
Right, and there's so many, you know, there's so many people who have checklists of, you know, what you have to say in a sermon and how you have to say it in a sermon, and all of a sudden the listener becomes a critic and is not really listening anymore, you know, and kind of, you know, I mean, those four things, it's kind of like, you know, what am I learning about Scripture? What am I learning about theology? How am I hearing about Jesus? And why does it matter in my life? Right? I mean, that's kind of, those are the things that you're working with. And it's, there's no one way to do it. And that's what makes preaching, as you said, so complex. Yeah. It's also what makes it so beautiful. It's what makes it so personal, because, you know, you have a reason for doing it the way you're doing it.
Right.
And, yeah. And that's the thing, right? If you're kind of, if you're listening to sermons and listening to a pastor, pastors love to talk about their sermons.
Right.
I mean, you know, because there's so much they don't get to say. There's so much that lies behind it. And so, you know, if you hear something that's weird or you hear something you don't understand, you just ask. And, you know, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, so my pastor was in a coffee shop. Oh, so he gets outside.
Right.
He was in a coffee shop.
He leaves the office.
Not often.
Yeah, and he thinks about people. And, you know, that's what was going on with that. And it's a, you know, and that's that issue of conversation, right? Yeah. The homily, that there's a conversation before, there's a conversation afterwards. So often we look at the sermon as this piece of the service that has to be done, and then it disappears. And it's not that. It's an ongoing dialogue, right? Yeah.
And I love the using these four threads of the tapestry, these four things that a preacher is trying to do in the sermon, to also describe the four things that a hearer is doing while the sermon is happening. And that's, I think, helpful for our listeners right here, right now. They're listening to sermons week in and week out. And I think part of the challenge of listening to sermons is we've maybe not taught our people what to listen for. So I have had lots of people tell me at the end of a church service, "Pastor, that was a good sermon." And I always wonder, what do they really mean by that? And maybe they're just being nice, and good sermon is like they're putting air quotes around it, you know. That was a good sermon, but I've heard a lot better. But if our listeners were thinking, okay, what did this teach me about the text? What did this teach me about theology? What did I learn about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus? And what does this have to say to my life? Then hearers could begin to ask questions of their pastor. Like, "Pastor, so I was listening to how you were talking about this text, and you kind of took it in this direction. What do you think about this direction?" And a preacher would probably say, "Yeah, I thought about that. And I thought about taking it in that direction too, and I just couldn't go in both directions."
Right.
And so I think that's really helpful to talk about how to even listen to a sermon, because I love the idea that our listeners would be having conversations with their pastor, especially if they're contemplating coming to the seminary, of kind of pulling back the veil or the curtain and really finding out, you know, how did this sermon get put together? That's fascinating to me.
I remember one of the first or of many lessons in Ham was you can't preach the entire counsel of God in one sermon.
Right.
And so you do have to begin and end somewhere. And some texts are radically dynamic.
Right.
And we've been talking about parables. There are different characters in the parables. The different characters have different roles, and those roles have implications. Those roles have consequences. And it's not always constructive to the task of preaching to do all of them.
Right.
Sometimes you have to focus on the one thing, and that means you're taking a part of a text and you're using the text around it to preach it, but you're really focusing on one point, and it for 20, 25 minutes that might be hyper focused, and you're like, well, what about the rest? It's like, well, it's helping. But if you want to learn more about the text, well now that's probably Bible study, mm-hmm. not the pulpit.
And right, yeah.
So it's just it's challenging because you, especially when you're reading a text that you've read many times, that you love, that you visit in different times of your life, and you're like, I want to tell everybody everything I've ever thought about these five verses. Well, it's just not possible.
Yeah. And sometimes the people, there's some part of the text that they're interested in, but that's not going to be on your radar today, right? And so there's a little bit of frustration, you know, and I think there's that task of forecasting to them, you know, what you're doing and why you're doing it. So parable of the prodigal son, right, or the prodigal father, whatever you want to call it. Like you said, three main characters. And sometimes you can lean into the father's relationship with the younger son. Mm-hmm. That's not actually where the parable ends and where it drives home for its original hearers. But it might be that for your people on that day, there's a reason why you're leaning into that. And you know, you just kind of share that with them. You say, you know, this is a very beautiful story, a long story. And this morning, I'd just like to focus on the first part of it, you know, and that then helps them. And then you can explain why, you know, here's why I think this really is an important part for us to think about.
For sure.
And then you move into that more fully. And, yeah, I think that textual piece is the one where there's often a lot of negotiation, and you don't want to just say everything you can. You have to be selective.
Yep. Yeah.
So I suppose that one challenge with preaching parables would just be to kind of just make the sermon an explanation.
Right.
Here's everything that's going on with the parable. And you know, some parables, Jesus did that with the disciples. He actually just said, here's what this means and here's what this means. But most of Jesus' parables, he doesn't actually give us the, here's the explanation, here's what's going on, and here's the point and all this kind of stuff. And so maybe a preacher is just tempted to just give an explanation. I suppose that's one way to do
it. That's one way. Yeah. It's I call it preaching the teaching.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, parables are really mysterious. They're, you know, I technically we talk about they're the rhetoric of entrapment. Mm-hmm. They're trying to catch you off guard. It's I think Will Willimon talked about how reading a parable is like looking out a window. And the light behind you shifts, and suddenly you see your face.
Mm.
And so you're reading this story that is just so different, and then suddenly it catches you. And so because they do that, they can be difficult. And you know, so like if I was doing the unjust steward, I would definitely do the preaching to teaching.
Yeah, yeah,
that parable is so complex.
Right. Our listeners now know two different theories
right.
about what that parable even means. And
right.
And it would take an entire sermon just to an entire episode, really, just to unpack that one parable.
Right.
And without any feelings whatsoever, I rarely admit, I've never preached that sermon.
Yeah.
Not because like, well, I mean, mm-hmm. so I even with Dr. Oswald, when we went into it last week, I think I have a better understanding of it now. And yet I still have this desire to go back and check and reread it again. Maybe like 15 years from now, I'll feel comfortable with that.
Yeah.
But that's, it's just it, exactly like you said, what Jesus is trying to do. He's trying to catch you off guard.
Right. And who you are changes how you're caught off guard. So 15 years from now, you're not going to be the same person.
Right? That is the goal. Yeah. At least one of the goals.
Yeah. So preaching the teaching is one way. I think the challenge with parables, at least for me, is that at some point in the sermon, you need to move from the story being told to the one telling the story, right? Because parables are the language of mystery, that the kingdom has not fully been revealed. And because it has not fully been revealed, Jesus is throwing out these parables to invite people to come closer to him. He's also, according to what he says in Mark, he's throwing out the parables in judgment upon those people who have rejected him.
Right.
And he's actually intentionally hiding the kingdom from them. So they're this language of mystery. After the death and resurrection, now the mystery's been revealed. Mm-hmm. And it is amazing, isn't it, that one-third of the teachings of Jesus are in parables, right? Something like that. And there's not a single parable in all of the Apostle Paul's works. Hmm. Not a single parable in Acts. The church didn't teach in parables after the death and resurrection, because there was a mystery that had been revealed that is now being proclaimed. And so there's always going to be this tension in the sermon between delighting in the mystery that this parable is bringing to us and the experiences that God's creating for us in this parable. But then at some point, we move from the story being told to the one telling the story. And that's where things become clear, because that's what the church has been given from God, is clarity in who Jesus Christ is and what he does. And so there's that movement. And so some pastors make that movement really quickly in preaching the teaching. Right. And other pastors, you know, the other pastors can do preaching the story, where they just really take you into the parabolic world of the parable and delve into that experience. But by the end of the sermon, there's going to be that shift at some point where you begin to see more clearly. And I think that's the challenge that you have in preaching on parables, is navigating how much time do we spend with the mystery.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, I think, part of the challenge with parables, like you said, is that Jesus, it appears from the Gospels, that Jesus wasn't teaching these parables because of kind of our modern conception that good teachers use parables, and this is kind of an engaging way to kind of draw your hearers in with a nice story. That doesn't seem to be what Jesus was doing with the parables at all. Sometimes it's exactly the opposite. Talking in parables, kind of speaking code to kind of push people away. And we've talked about that a little bit throughout this series. And so...
Yeah, and you know that the Old Testament text that's quoted there is from Isaiah's call,
right?
And his vision. And...
So that hearing they won't hear.
Right,
and so that
seeing they won't see. But you remember, if you read that whole text, there's an end to that ministry. You know, God calls Isaiah and says, you know, do this so that seeing they won't see, hearing they won't hear, until everything is laid waste, until all of the forests are cut down, until all you have left is the stump.
Whoa.
Right?
Yeah.
And then later in Isaiah 11, we see that this stump, this root, begins to bring new life. And if you think about that, you know, metaphorically, Jesus preaches in parables until everything is laid waste and until he's dead on a cross. And that's when you have the turn. Wow. That's when you see the new life. And now there's a proclamation of this mystery that was hidden for ages, right? Yeah. That now has been revealed. And so there's kind of this... There's this, you know, I agree with you that the, you know, people, if you look at the parables through pedagogy and say, you know, this is a good way, tell a story, Jesus told stories, you tell stories too, Okay. And I'm all for telling stories, as you know, in my preaching. Right, I tell stories all the time. I'm all for telling stories, but not because Jesus told parables. Because those parables are a very different beast. They're a very specific kind of ministry that Jesus was doing until his death and resurrection. And so we as preachers are taking hold of these little pieces of that proclamation of Jesus in the midst of his ministry. And somehow we've got to move from that mystery into the light at some point. Yeah.
So I enjoy preaching parables again because it's this ready illustration.
Yeah.
And yet that heightens the difficulty of it, at least in my mind when I'm preparing a sermon, because the context for the hearers for where the parable was first spoken, radically different than today. And even then, the context is just different.
Right.
So you have that challenge. And that's always the challenge of preaching scripture today.
Right.
Because there is an original context that does matter for what those words specifically mean. But now you get this added context that often doesn't have an explanation, that is mysterious, and you're trying to decipher it. So you're just trying to decipher something through two or three lenses. And I'll ask about this in a second, different formats for preaching, because you should change them up, so you don't get stale and boring, and people can't always guess, look at their watch, and it's like, oh, now here comes the gospel, right? But those added layers, it heightens the challenge, which makes it more fun as a preacher, the challenge. But sometimes you can just get carried away. Not often, but sometimes I find myself preaching the terrible and I haven't even done the preaching and the teaching thing. I've just been talking. Mm-hmm. Not vainly or absently, but like, man, at some point now, because we're like 15 minutes in this sermon, I got to do a little preaching here that actually matters to the people in the pews. You can get lost in that realm of mystery if you allow yourself to be.
Right. Yeah, it's very seductive, isn't it? Yeah.
Again, because they do pull you in, and I'll because especially, I don't know, Ben, if you have anything else you want to add to this before we talk about different styles of preaching or different. Yeah. I think you can do it in a way. There are different styles that lend better to parables, and there's one classical style that Lutherans love that I don't think works well with parables, but that's just me.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts? Before I ask the big question and ask to explain different styles of preaching?
Well, the only thing else that I was going to say is that whole insight of parables being part of God's design for the prophets proclaiming to the people of God until the everything is laid waste, until the stump is revealed, is this beautiful exegetical, biblical insight that really does a nice job of rounding out this entire series from a biblical standpoint. And I think one thing that I know we've talked about lots is that when you come to the seminary and you're in a preaching class, you shouldn't expect the preaching professor to have nothing to say about the Bible. Right? So you're actually an amazing biblical theologian and not just giving like tips and tricks on how to make a sermon kind of neat or fun or interesting.
Raise your voice here.
Right. And use dramatic this kind pause of there. Gesture, you know, wave your hand in a certain way.
Oh,
and,
gosh. Yeah.
So
sometimes you're right. Sometimes people treat preaching or the art of preaching as decoration.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, really in our entire department of practical theology, sometimes is seen as kind of the, put a nice bow on the package, as opposed to this rigorous, deeply theological, really interested in all the theology, all the Bible, the history.
But like you said, the hard part is that the practical theology really brings to the table life today.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's when it gets messy, is all of a sudden. If I can just bracket out people listening,
right,
and just talk about what it meant in its original context, it's a lot easier. I mean, yeah, it's hard,
right, right,
but it's a lot easier. The minute you bring in people today and all the stuff going on today, now all of a sudden it's like, man, this is very complex.
Exactly. The other thing that I think practical theology does is it's I love reading books about theology. That's just part of our craft, right? Yeah. I like thinking about theology, but practical theology will not let you stop at the thinking of it. The just thinking nice thoughts. You actually have to have a sermon on Sunday morning when that sermon hymn ends, and you gotta stand up and say something.
Right.
And so practical theology at its best is bringing all this biblical insight and all this theological insight, historical insight, and then actually doing it.
Doing something with it.
Yeah, doing something with it, which is beautiful, but also very complex. And so I like to think about practical theology as the way to wrap it all together, where we can't just say, well, these are interesting insights. And I love how our curriculum and our seminary, all of our colleagues on the faculty work together.
That's the beauty of coming to a seminary, right? That you're in the midst of a group of people who are in conversation with one another. We're not in our little silos. Yep. So I know the stuff Okamoto's doing. I know the stuff Bierman's doing. And, you know, and all of a sudden, you're interacting with one another. And, you know, your students here, you're able to interact with various profs. You're able to interact with other students who are interacting with various profs. And you're beginning to, because the task that we're talking about, holding it all together, that's the hard part.
That is the hard
part. And it's better, I think, it's better to do that in community than to do it in isolation.
Yeah. Oh, right? Right.
And so you kind of learn how to do it by doing it with others.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
I have that conversation a lot with people, like, you know, why do I need church? I have my Bible, I sit at home and I read it. Why isn't that enough? I'm like, okay, let's get to this really confusing parable, and how do you understand it? And do you think not just the church today, but the people who heard it first thought about it the way that you're thinking about it? And that's just one part. The community aspect of seminary and the church is really God's design for all of this, because, I mean, from the very beginning, it's not good for man to be alone. That wasn't just applied to Adam. That's all of us. We are creatures of community, and the church should be the place where that is highly exemplified.
Yeah.
And demonstrated for the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of practical theology. I'm not in the practical department. I could switch. I probably won't. Anyway.
Well, we do have a way of bringing people from other departments into the Department of Practical Theology.
When you were starting, because my favorite thing, and I say this boldly, my favorite thing that we do is teaching. I love teaching confirmation. 10-year-olds to 13-year-olds, that group that people don't want to be around, I love being around them because their minds are so sharp and so curious. And they ask really good questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I just enjoy that time with them, and they have this desire to grow. So I love teaching. So we learn all this theology so that we can preach it and teach it comprehensively. Maybe I'll just do another PhD. I'm just lying. Anyway, slightly moving on before I talk myself into applying to a different department. We have these different styles of teaching, and it does matter. I think some people won't think so. If you could give, I'm trying to think, if I counted what I would think are like the major styles that we mostly gravitate to, the historical one I was talking about, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with this, law gospel. You preach the law, then you preach the gospel. And that's a very classical way of preaching God's word. And then there's ways in law and gospel to do that. I think the way that we were taught was maybe 4 pages.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy doing that when it's applicable. And then there's text application, where that's probably the one I gravitate towards the most, where you preach the text and you preach what it means to us.
That's very satisfying for hearers, right?
Right.
Because it's kind of what we do when we read the Bible by ourselves, right?
Exactly.
We read it, we try to understand it, and then think about how it applies. And so to do that as a group on Sunday morning,
in a pinch, that's the one I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Because it's the one I enjoy the most. And if you're enjoying what you're doing, more times than not, people are going to like listening to it.
Right.
when it comes to, and I, there are probably other types of styles, but I wanted to get to this one because I think that this one lends itself best to parables because of what they are and because we were talking about. That's expository preaching, going verse by verse, and just preaching the story and going in and out of the text as you go. I think the way you taught it was like you get in a bus and you're going on this bus in the text, and then every once in a while you have to get a stop and you get everybody off the bus.
Right.
And that's when you stop and maybe you take a moment to step, not away from the text, but out of the text to preach to the people in context. Styles I'm missing, Ben Yerham, professor. Those are the three that...
Well, there's image-based.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, you've got image-based and...
I mean, there are more.
There's
so many different styles.
There's as many as there are preachers.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, well, that could be a whole conversation. I mean, there's a whole, like, relational preaching that some very famous preachers have kind of invented or tried, and it really helps to kind of have this conversation between me and what God is saying and... What the we are kind of thinking,
I'm just going back to like Hom 1.
Yeah.
Just trying to think of like the basics.
Yeah, well, and that's the fun thing in Hom. For some of us, you know, if we grow up in a church, we hear one kind of preaching. And to us, that's the way you preach,
right?
And then you kind of you come into a homiletics class, and you realize that not everybody in the class had that same kind of preaching, right? Mm-hmm. And that's when you start seeing the great variety in preaching. And I think there's a great variety in preaching, primarily because there's a great variety of people God's trying to reach.
Yeah.
and pastors are going to have different gifts, and they're going to be leaning into one style more than another.
Right.
Yeah.
I think this is one of the great things that a prospective student to the seminary could do, is just to start listening to preaching.
Yeah.
And whether it's coming as a future pastor or as a deaconess, hearing the word preached and listening to all these different ways that it gets preached by all these different kinds of preachers is just to become curious.
Well, if I could plug something.
Yeah, please.
So there's this thing called Preacher Studio,
right?
Where you've got a sermon, it's at concordiatheology.org, you've got a sermon, you can listen to the sermon, and then you've got a conversation with the preacher so that you kind of hear, oh, so that's what was going on in his mind, that's what he was doing. And so it's a nice way of getting to look at the backside of the sermon, right?
Yeah.
You know, we just look at the front so often, and we think about how it's affecting us and everything, and all of a sudden you're kind of looking at the other side and saying, oh, so that's what he was doing. And yeah, it's a nice way of getting introduced to the art. Yeah.
And you've done lots of
those. I have. Yeah, those are always fun.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of those. Yeah.
And that is there's so many great conversations because you do get to hear what the preacher was thinking, sitting at the coffee shop, and how the preacher decided to, you know, make all these choices.
Yeah.
Because that's a huge part of what preaching is about, is deciding what you're going to do with the texts and what you're going to do with preaching Christ and how you're preaching it to the particular group of people. So, yeah, that's fun. I think that's a great thing. ConcordiaTheology.org.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one thing we also like to do is, as we're sitting here, Dr. Schmidt is, for our listeners, again, a slight variety of listeners and demographic, who they are, pastors, maybe prospective students one day, but especially for those who might be thinking about ministry, what would be one piece of advice that you would have for them right now, as they're hopefully maybe considering emailing us and saying, hey, this has been on my heart, I think I want to pursue ministry? What would that advice be to them?
I would say talk to somebody. Don't just let it sit in your head. Talk to somebody. You know, it's a way of verbalizing it, And even if you never come to the seminary, just to verbalize that you were thinking about it, mm-hmm. that's something that people will appreciate. And, you know, you begin a conversation and that person can pray for you. Mm. That person, you know, it's kind of like you've taken it from inside and put it out there. That's what I would do, really. Yeah. I think that's probably for me, that would be the most important thing. It begins to make it a little bit more real, and it opens you up to the possibility that God will use others to support you and affirm you. Yeah, that's what I would say.
You know, we did an episode on calls and how they're mediated. Yeah. You know, that wasn't by accident. Not by our design, yeah. but by the author's design of all of this. Well, this has been an incredible episode. Again, again, thinking about the task of preaching, we could go on about it here, but again, go to the Preacher Studio, because that'll give you not just a highlight for this podcast, but again, the art and craft of preaching from a variety of different angles, from a variety of different perspectives. You can hear different, well, on this particular Sunday, this was going on in the context of why I was preaching, and this is why I took this text in this particular direction, because like practical ministry says, ministry happens in real time, in a real age, and this is the age we're in, and God's word is still speaking to us today. And how is it then speaking at us in a way that impacts our hearts and minds, calls us to action, and to live out our Christian vocations? And maybe that Christian vocation for you includes being a preacher and teacher of the gospel.
I hope it does.
Same. Well, thank you again, Dr. Schmidt, for joining us on Under the Fig Tree. We'll have to do this again sometime. Maybe pick a particular text and do what you do on Preacher Studios so they can see the art on Under the Fig Tree as well. Well, everybody, take care and God's blessings.